Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, should the First Amendment provision of freedom of speech and freedom of expression apply to business? While the impact of corporate interest in the political process has been widely debated in the wake of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, my guest today has written about an overall expansion of free speech rights for corporation and commercial interests that's only appeared in the last 35 years of our history. My guest today is University of Tulsa Law Professor Tamara Piety, who says that these expanding free speech rights for businesses could imperil public health, safety, and welfare, the reliability of consumer information, and the stability of financial markets. Despite the assertions of some that say corporations are people, Piety, in her book Brandishing the First Amendment, Corporate Expression in America, argues that the corporation is not the moral equivalent of an individual citizen and therefore should be subject to reasonable restrictions on its commercial speech and expression. Tamara Piety is a professor of law at the University of Tulsa and the associate dean for faculty development at the TU Law School. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Tamara Piety, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
In a presidential campaign where you have a presidential candidate saying that corporations are people, and in recent weeks we've seen a proposed boycott of a corporation be actually attacked as an infringement on that company's First Amendment rights of free speech, we've obviously come to a new place when it comes to corporate speech and commercial speech. This is a big change from the way it used to be in this country.
Yes, it is. It's a big change from in my lifetime. But it wasn't the case that corporations or advertising, and there's a distinction here between corporate speech and commercial speech, but advertising and promotional activities had any First Amendment protection at all, or that anyone thought the First Amendment was implicated by them. It started in about 1976 and has had a lot of powerful interests promoting this point of view and generating a lot of scholarship, and you see where we are today.
Is there any sense that the founders considered commercial speech a part of the First Amendment, of that freedom of speech?
Well, there is some historical evidence, and some people have argued that in context, in that historical evidence of, say, the importance of the advertising, particularly about ships coming in from abroad and bringing goods, that this was something that the framers had in mind. But there are so many differences between the society then and now that it's hard to draw from that they could have meant the kind of promotional activities we now live with. And certainly whatever the framers thought was included, for probably 150 years, no one thought that it was included. And in 1942, in fact, that argument was explicitly made and rejected by the Supreme Court. They said, no, that's, the First Amendment has no bearing on commercial placards or handouts. And that's the way it remained until 1976.
What happened in 1976?
Well, in 1976, we had a case brought by some consumers against the State Board of Pharmacy in Virginia, arguing that the state of Virginia's law prohibiting price advertising was unconstitutional, and that it was unconstitutional because it was keeping people from getting information that was really important and necessary. And it was a consumers group that brought the case. And the Supreme Court struck the law down. It said that although the First Amendment is typically thought of in terms of speakers, that there was also a parallel listener's right under the First Amendment, and that this statute infringed on that listener's right to hear truthful information. So they created something that has become known as the commercial speech doctrine, and what it did was it carved out a little special area of protection for something that hadn't been protected before. That was advertising, commercial promotion. And it said, if something is truthful and not misleading, which is a really important additional caveat, if it's truthful and not misleading, then it's going to be presumptively protected unless the government can show that whatever law they have that's infringing on that truthful information is really important. It advances a substantial interest. it does so the most minimal way possible, or it substantially advances that interest, and it does so in the most minimal way possible. And this test was articulated in a case called Central Hudson in 1980 and has been the controlling test for the remaining time since to the present. One of the things that happened, though, is that originally that test was viewed as something called a rational basis. That meant the government didn't have to do very much to meet the test, and so any law that was challenged would probably survive. But over time, it became more like a strict scrutiny test. That is, the government would lose most of the time, and most challenges would win, even though the law technically was the same.
It's interesting that the people who brought suit, it was about the rights of the people hearing the message, not the rights of the people who were sending the message. That seems to have totally flipped.
Well, no, it hasn't flipped, actually.
But when you hear the rhetoric surrounding all these issues today,
right,
they're asserting that it has flipped.
Well, no, they haven't flipped it. It's a little bit like heads I win, tails you lose, right? So what happened is that really soon after Virginia Pharmacy, which involved commercial speech, commercial advertising about a fact, how much does this prescription drug cost? 2 years later, there was another case that was involving political advertising called First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti. And Bilotti built on Virginia Pharmacy, and it articulated what was subsequently used as a statement from the court that it didn't matter who was speaking, if it was a corporation or if it was an individual, that if the speech in question was the kind of speech that had traditionally been protected, it would be protected even if it was a corporation that was uttering it. And what that did is it opened the door to corporate participation in political speech. In that case, it was a referendum on personal property taxes that the bank wanted to do. The state of Massachusetts had a law prohibiting that kind of advertising, and the bank had announced it was wanting to do something. The state attorney general had announced that he viewed that as violation of the law, and so they brought a declaratory judgment action trying to get a statement from the court that whether or not it was constitutional. The court said it was. And it was really interesting because both of the parties, the bank and Bilotti, who was the state attorney general of Massachusetts then, understood the question to be, do corporations have the same First Amendment rights as individuals? That's the way they presented the case to the court. And Justice Powell, who was not the author of the Virginia Pharmacy opinion, but who was apparently some of the intellectual
force
behind this, mm-hmm. Did write the opinion in Bilotti, and he said that question is the wrong question. The question is whether or not this speech is the speech that's traditionally been protected. And with that sort of sleight of hand, ushered in a era of protection for corporate speech. And we still, mind you, had many laws that governed corporate participation in elections, and then some more like McCain-Feingold that were passed after that decision in an attempt to control corporate participation in elections. But we see with Citizens United that they have not survived, or they've been chipped away at.
What was the legal underpinning of that decision?
Well, it was the...
Or is it an expansion of a whole new class of rights?
Well, you could say it was both. A lot of the interests that were arguing for this sort of full protection for corporate speech or commercial speech, both of these categories, what the proponents of this interpretation of the First Amendment did was they leveraged the language of civil rights and said the First Amendment actually has an equality principle too. It's not appropriate to discriminate among speakers. And so it's not appropriate to discriminate among speakers, then obviously you can't discriminate on the basis of corporate identity. And one of the things I argue in my book and that I have argued elsewhere is that invidious discrimination against human beings is, of course, prohibited, but that discriminating between corporations is not invidious discrimination. And so this idea of equality, that the First Amendment requires you to treat for-profit and not-for-profit corporations the same, or all corporations, no matter what their...
Or corporations or labor unions.
Or labor unions the same way, that this is just not... This is nonsense. You don't need to do that.
Let's talk about that argument. You said that basically corporations are not people. They are capital.
Right. They're aggregations of capital, and they're fictitious entities, right? There's a case in, I think in Kansas, in a district court that has struck down part of the mandate in the Health Care Act on the grounds the corporation who brought the suit, it violates its rights to free exercise of their religious freedom under the First Amendment because of the mandate with regard
to birth control.
Yeah. Right. And completely disregards in that equation in discussing whether or not this corporation, even though it's a for-profit, it's organized as a secular corporation, but much like Kathy and Chick-fil-A, right, the company is trying to imbue the corporation with the founder's sort of religious values. And
but the corporate charter does not go to a church, does it?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't go to a church, and the court doesn't, I mean, the judge in that case doesn't really consider whether it's appropriate for the employer to be able to impose on his or her employees the attributes or the ancillary requirements of their own religious beliefs when it comes to, you know, basic things like healthcare.
That would be a big expansion of corporate rights. If that would invalidate an awful lot of discrimination laws if a for-profit corporation can say, you're Jewish, we're Christian, you can't work here. You know,
right.
I mean, that's crazy.
Or you can work here, but only if you're observant of our religious beliefs. And if you don't like that, then you can find
a job
elsewhere.
Which, of course, in most corporations, that's sort of, you know, a lot of times that sort of goes without question. You know, the Christmas party, it's not,
right.
It's not, there's no Hanukkah party.
There's no Hanukkah party, right? And there's no option for, it seems like sometimes it is frowned upon if you are, you don't belong to the dominant group in terms of religion or even particular affiliation of faith.
For a nonprofit organization, say a church,
right.
that's a moot question, right? I mean, you could say, well, we can't have, if this invalidates your faith tradition, that's not at play, is it?
Well, I think it's complicated because if
it
it's
could
a
be
church,
a university.
If it's a church and it's really straightforward as a religious organization, but then you move into sort of religious affiliated, like a university
or
a charity or a hospital and so forth. But going back to this sort of what the court has done is and the ties between this idea of the corporate entity having speaker's rights that has emerged in the political speech side. And this idea that commercial advertising and commercial marketing should also enjoy full First Amendment protection, these two things are tied together. And they're tied together in a really interesting way that I think, you know, because if you think about it, the corporation's core speech is going to be commercial marketing. And what I think, and I've written an article that sort of has that title, but what I think that they would like to get, you know, industry would like to have is robust First Amendment protection for anything they say that's promotional, and while at the same time enjoying robust trademark and copyright protection in the courts for any speech that they don't like, and the ability to go after people for not just trademark and copyright, but also commercial disparagement, libel. So, you know, you see Oprah being sued by the beef over the mad cow reference, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. A lot of states have passed these statutes, veggie libel statutes. So you can't disparage vegetables. You can disparage Oprah, but you can't a human being, but you can't disparage broccoli, right? So, I just think that's unwise. It rolls back probably 100 years of consumer protection law. That's because traditionally, and you probably know this very well, but in media and broadcast with respect to libel law and journalism, the standard that that the First Amendment interpretation that applies in that context has always been very, very protective and one that tolerates a certain amount of falsity.
Yeah.
And tolerates...
As long as there's no malice beforehand to
right.
harm the individual.
Yeah,
right.
As long as it's not said with actual malice and knowledge of falsity, the idea is that we have to tolerate a certain amount of falsity to get the good stuff. I don't think we need to tolerate false advertising. And what the good stuff is really, I mean, the benefit to consumers is really more questionable. I mean, because I think they know, the proponents know, that it wouldn't be nearly so attractive a case to push for full First Amendment protection on behalf of the speakers in the commercial advertising. They always frame it in terms of the listener's interests, as the Virginia Pharmacy case did, as if the ability to have unchecked advertising bombarding you all the time is an obvious good and that you would want to have that and that this is a benefit to you that that nanny state government wants to come in and stop you from getting all the advertising you want. Well, actually, time and time again, we've seen that people would like to avoid advertising. They would like to TiVo it or skip through the pop-up ads or watch the show without the ads and stop getting direct mail or don't have phone calls coming to there. And consumers love the do not call registry. So trying to say that consumers are just wild about advertising and really need to have it is questionable.
My guest today is Tamara Piety, Associate Dean for Faculty Development at the University of Tulsa, Professor of Law there. Her book is titled Brandishing the First Amendment, Commercial Expression in America, which gets to the heart of this sort of change in commercial speech and how it's viewed by the court system and what their rights are. You mentioned the fact that that companies would like the protection of being able to advertise freely, but also want to be able to suppress others who might be infringing on their copyright. There's actually a court case that was settled out of court eventually, but sort of gets to the heart of this. It involves Nike,
right.
In which, you know, Nike was in trouble over its where it was making its product and was it involving child labor or substandard labor
right.
conditions. And Nike came out with an ad that said, oh, no, everything is blue, sunshiny skies, basically. And and somebody filed suit saying, well, no, we actually know the substandard conditions and violations of sort of universal human rights in these factories where their product is made. And the courts pretty much left that up in limbo, didn't they? Whether they have the right to say things that they know are false.
Right. That it was... It was left somewhat in limbo, and Nike argued to the Supreme Court that unless there was clarity on this, the California law that would seem to require that their statements be true when they make them about their labor practices would mean that they could not do their corporate social responsibility reports that were required in the European Union and elsewhere. And I think time has proven that has not been a real obstacle for them because the California law continues to be what it is, and it doesn't seem to have put a big crimp in their business. It was a little complicated because basically what happened is at the time, California, like many states, had what they called mini FTC acts. They were consumer protection acts intended to allow consumers to bring an action on behalf of the public, so what they call a private attorneys general. And this fellow, Caskey, saw these representations, and they were not all in ads. Many of them were in letters to the editor. They were in advertorials, so they took out ad time, but they made a pitch, and they made a sort of a statement about their practices. They were in letters to athletic directors at universities saying what their labor practices were. And Caskey had other evidence, letters from people at Nike suggesting that the statements made to try to rehabilitate their image were things that they knew were false. So he sued. He said that this was injured the public, but he didn't claim he had ever bought any Nike shoes. And Nike responded to that with a technical, the term is demur, but it's basically asking the court to dismiss it, saying that this is not something you can settle in court. It's kind of like a big so what. Yeah. So you've said this, but that's not something for which you can get legal redress. And the trial court agreed with Nike and dismissed the case. And so did the appellate court. And the California Supreme Court came back and said, well, you know, some of this stuff looks like advertising. And if it's advertising, it doesn't have First Amendment protection unless it's true. And so we're going to send it back to go forward to discovery and to that whole process, so, at which point they settled.
Right. But first it went to the Supreme Court whether he could actually sue, and the Supreme Court just said, no, we're not going to touch this.
Right. No, when they lost in the California Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court said, go back to the trial court, Nike took another route and petitioned for cert to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court took the case, it heard oral argument, and then surprisingly and disappointingly to many people, it issued an order saying that cert had been improvidently granted and they were not going to decide the case.
Which basically means we don't want to touch this case with a 10-foot pole.
No, I was on a panel with another academic shortly after the case who said that his informal impression was that they didn't think that the defendant in this case, that Nike wasn't the greatest poster child for this principle. If they wanted to announce this principle, it wouldn't be the best case to do it in because the lawsuit that was filed had attached to it copies of letters, and it was what is known as a verified complaint, that it was a complaint under oath and it had evidence attached to it, and actually one count that was fraud and deceit. And that was kind of a remarkable and not an ordinary thing to respond to a claim of fraud by saying the First Amendment protects fraud. and that basically was what they were looking for, was protection for whatever they wanted to say in the PR side as opposed to traditional advertising. One of the things I argue in the book is I think this development of First Amendment protection for corporations and for commercial speech activity is relatively new, and none of the sort of theoretical justifications that have ever been advanced by anyone, as far as I can tell, until relatively recently, for why we have a First Amendment would seem to be furthered by protecting commercial and corporate speech. In other words, like if we have a First Amendment, the reason we have it is to further people's autonomy and the development of their freedom and so forth. If a person says, I don't want to receive marketing calls, that seems to me to be an autonomous decision, and that it doesn't advance their autonomy to say, well, whether you like it or not, you've got to be a target for a marketer. Mm-hmm. You know, similarly, if we talk about democracy, we have the First Amendment because we really want to have robust political discourse. Well, we don't necessarily have robust political discourse through more commercial speech. And as has been, I think, observed by a lot of people, the imbalance and sort of the speaker resources can mean that there aren't a lot of viewpoints being advanced by permitting corporate participation. But it's also encouraged us to think of political activity more in terms of consumption than in terms of the old kind of voting, town hall meetings, things like that. And so it seems natural to think about political activity as boycotts, when actually, while I agree they can be useful and they were useful in the civil rights, they're not as useful as we would hope them to be, where you can't get good information about the truth of a company's practices. And this is one of the things about environmental stuff.
Yeah.
And they can be relatively ineffective with the very large corporation as opposed to a smaller local business.
Getting to that last point, you know, the Citizens United decision, it doesn't look like the court is going to revisit that anytime soon. In fact, there was a Montana law that was recently struck down through the same process. But there was a part of the decision which said that uh, if if Congress wants to make full disclosure of what a corporation does, we see no problem with that. In fact, that was sort of the key part of this decision that, you know, if everybody's out free and board and you can see what this corporation is doing politically, then, you know, buyer beware or, you know, they should have these rights. Congress shows no sign of making that disclosure possible. Is it possible the court will revisit that if Congress doesn't add disclosure?
I don't know. And I have to say that many of the people who have been pushing for this First Amendment right for corporate speech and for commercial speech are not on board with that disclosure part. I mean, Justice Thomas wasn't, and James Bopp, who was the person who represented Citizens United all the way up to the Supreme Court, has his new sort of argument, the specialty, is attacking these disclosure laws. And his argument is that those are also unconstitutional. And part of the reason they're unconstitutional is precisely because people can then intimidate you for your political participation by perhaps, let's say, boycotting your products.
I don't know. An individual has that same intimidation by their employer, by other people listening to their message. It seems like that's part of free speech.
Right. You know, certainly like our political contributions. There was someone, I think, in town at one point who was collecting prominent Tulsans. And I hadn't realized I was prominent until that moment. And their political contributions saying, you know, basically don't patronize these people. And in this case, I guess it would mean don't go to law school. But, but you know, since I'm not running a business, but I think that this idea of disclosure probably is not going to get out of Congress. And I think there are plenty of conservatives that are really concerned about corporate money in politics, but they are now so deeply entrenched that it's not clear that anybody can change it. So, and the court has actually done a couple other interesting things recently in the Stolen Valor case. This was a case about the guy claiming to have Medal of Honor and he didn't. And of course they struck down the law that prohibited him from claiming that. And buried in there was a little site. And they gave a long string site of cases in which there have been exceptions to this vigorous First Amendment protection, fighting words, obscenity. And there's typical cases that are always associated with each of those. And one category that's always been included in that list is commercial speech. So typically when this list is generated, they'll say commercial speech, cite Virginia Pharmacy. Except this time in Stolen Valor case, it says fraud, Virginia Pharmacy. And fraud is much narrower than the commercial speech doctrine. Mm. The commercial speech doctrine was never limited to fraud. It was like fraud and misleading, and a great deal of the Federal Trade Commission's jurisdiction involves prohibiting or sanctioning advertising that, while technically true, is misleading to most people. So, and there was like no fanfare about that at all.
Well, it's very interesting, changing field of law, sounds like.
It's very dynamic.
Tamara Piety, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
University of Tulsa law professor Tamara Piety speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her new book is titled Brandishing the First Amendment, Commercial Expression in America. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.